So hello, everybody. Following that introduction, if you do happen to be passing through Ann Arbor at any time, please do say hello. I'm sure, just based on your presence here, that we'll have a lot in common and a lot to talk about. I won't be able to stay at this conference much later today, unfortunately, because of work and scheduling issues that are incredibly stupid. But I would be delighted if anyone wants to email me after the talk with further questions, further ideas, war stories from media history. My address will be on the last slide. It's an honor to be presenting to this group. Some really important things have come out of the USENIX gatherings, and I won't bore you with your own history, but suffice it to say that this is a privilege, and I hope you'll find some stuff to entertain and provoke you here and get this day started right. This morning, I'm going to be talking about dead media. Over the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to argue a couple of points. First, the history of media, and by media, I mean devices and platforms to store, transmit, and represent information, taken generally. This history is not a history of teleological progress that ends up where we are, but a constant Cambrian explosion of different and diverse forms, most of which don't make it. Spoiler alert. Second, while many of these forms are slight variations on what turned out to be successful, others represent very different and unrealized media futures, and these still offer creative potential to us to shake us up and present us with different ways of making and doing. I'll be talking about some of those, the weird ones, later on. Third, there's a huge difference between the intentions of inventors and the uses which ultimately become common. People often build things for very culturally specific reasons that might go away, but the hardware is still there to be taken up anew. Media get adopted and readopted and reinvented, and preparing for those transformations is part of building media platforms now. It's a culturally complex phenomenon. Finally, number four, this stuff is worthwhile to study and to talk about here this morning and take up your valuable time, because bearing these things in mind and seeing them in action can help us look to the future in our own work. So I'm going to get from there in the upper left-hand corner to down in the lower right-hand corner by talking about where the idea of dead media comes from and then telling some stories from its history, telephone music, television without pictures, emotional Photoshop filters in the 17th century, light synthesizers, and so on, that kind of thing, and then closing with some takeaways. So to start, what do we mean by the dead in dead media? This is not what we mean. This is your mandatory beginning of presentation joke, which we're going to get through right now. This is a medium named Eva Carriere, a spiritualist who's communicating with the spirits in the great beyond in 1912. You can see that lump of ectoplasm that looks like a pillbox hat on top of her head. I swear to you, this photo is not retouched in any way and features no cheesecloth. And she has that awesome light manifestation between her hands. It's a beautiful picture. She was born in 1886, so she's presumably deceased. And we'll get back to her in a second, but this is not the kind of dead medium that we mean. Dead media is a naggingly imprecise term. Aside from some things that are really dead, like dead languages, like these Rongo Rongo boards from Easter Island, where we've truly lost the ability, we can just barely speculate as to exactly what these were referring to, what they meant, how they worked. Aside from things like that, does it really make sense to talk about these things, media, that are dead in such different ways? I've heard people use the term dead media when talking about mail sent by rockets, that's down in the lower corner there, and objects called black mirrors in the upper row in the center, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on, and records cut from old X-ray photographs in the Soviet Union, which is down there in the middle, and dial a poem, which is in the upper corner there, and in-vehicle 45 RPM record players, and Plan 9 from Bell Labs. These are all obviously different, and their fates were diverse, and arguably some of them aren't dead at all. I mean, rocket mail was never really a viable project. Rockets were very romantic, and they were the future of transportation. But the cost-benefit ratio of having to send a bunch of mail up in a rocket doesn't really scale. And in-car record players were a really bad idea, but they looked sort of exciting when Detroit was first putting them together. You know, the car is bouncing all the time. This is not a model that's going to succeed. The X-ray records were made by dissident Soviet musicians because they could get X-rays and they were kind of somewhat similar material to vinyl lacquer, so they could cut them on record machines. These were a terrible substitute for LPs. And when this, you know, oppressive regime that made them necessary went away, they did too. Dial-a-Palme was an art project, and it depended on its participants having the energy to do it, and eventually they didn't. And Plan 9, there may actually be people who worked on it, is in many ways not dead at all. It's been ported to some different OSs, it lives on as Inferno. I know a lot of people who actually use Acme and SAM on a day-to-day basis, and I actually do myself sometimes. So I know I'm speaking to an audience of precise thinkers. And you're wondering what could possibly unify these things with such unique properties and histories. To explain that, we need to understand what the term dead media was meant to do when it first appeared. And since we're using it, it was coined by the science fiction writer Bruce Sterling in 1995 at a talk at the International Symposium on Electronic Art. And his goal was to invite the phantom of the past into the trade show of hand-waving, hot air, hype, and venture capital that was the beginning of the dot-com boom. He wanted to bring in the phantom of everything that had gone away or become obsolete or never taken off in the first place. He wanted to remind these creative types that he was speaking to at that conference not to get blindsided by the marketing and PR of the moment. This is when AT&T was doing their You Will campaign, and every hip artist was supposed to be sinking years of effort into making an interactive multimedia CD-ROM that only ran on Mac System 7, and only with the right version of QuickTime, and the right version of HyperCard, and so on. So one of the canonical examples that people use when they talk about this moment when Sterling came up with this phrase was because it was the death throes of this device. I don't know if anybody recognizes it. This is a canonical example. This is the Doomsday Book running on a BBC Micro on that table. The original Doomsday Book was a survey of England and Wales done in the year 1086 for William the Conqueror to assess with some accuracy the land, livestock, towns, and owners, to basically accurately levy taxes. It's a fantastic historical resource, obviously. It was called the Domesday Book because this kind of total survey and calling to account kind of overlapped in people's minds at that point with the Day of Judgment in the Bible, where there's like a gathering of everyone's fate and everyone is accounted for. So 1,000 years later, the BBC, well, 900 years later, give or take, the BBC embarked on this colossal effort in multimedia production with input from more than 1 million people, sort of a, you know, large survey like the original, to both update and comment on the original. The result is on this LaserVision ROM disk, and it became virtually unreadable within less than 2 decades. The BBC Micro was not a successful platform. Only heroic reverse engineering, emulation, and archival research projects made it sort of available again, and even then, not really in the form it was originally designed in. This was before JPEG, so all the pictures of this thing are single frames of analog video that have to be captured and transformed in various ways. All the software was written in a precursor to C called the Basic Combined Programming Language, which some people may be familiar with. So this was not just a matter of copying some stuff off a disk to salvage it. This was a huge and expensive project to save this thing. I'd like to point out that the original book, which is 900 years old, we can still read just fine. It's just waiting for us to flip through it. But yeah, this didn't even make it into the turn of the millennium. So, not to put too fine a point on it, but much of the new media stuff in Sterling's time, the stuff he was addressing, and in our time, was an attempt to sell something and move on. So Sterling came to speak against the new hotness by pointing his audience towards the dead media as a general term for the obsolete, the dysfunctional, the has-beens and never-wases, the many alternatives that were better or worse or just different, to change our understanding so we don't have a picture that's like this, but one that's more like this. Not a smooth curve of development with no outliers, arriving inevitably at what we happen to have now, but a Burgess Shale type event of many different forms, most of which did not survive. So we can think of our own work in light of that, and we can start to build with the past and the future of media in mind. Because along with being fascinating and often funny, looking deeply into the history of media can offer us insights into how things work and fail to work. And I don't just mean technically. Along with offering physical, material capabilities and constraints, the stuff of chemistry and engineering and programming, a media technology offers stories to us, narratives. These are stories, when we build a media platform, about how we think the future should be, about how we conceive of thinking and communication. One thing we won't go into too much here, but is a fascinating sidelight in this whole history, is various media platforms trying to determine what the size of a thought is. Is the atomic size of a thought the size of an index card? Because you can build filing systems for that. Is it like a book? Is it a codex? Is it something that you link through? So there's all these kind of like factors in how we think about what our culture is supposed to be like that are reflected in our hardware. And these media platforms show us the deep and often irrational desires that drive our projects. These are questions that we need to answer anew again and again. Answering them in the media systems we build is part of how we form our civilization. And this audience happens to be in a really great position to shape some of these answers. So one of the lessons is that people who made even successful things didn't know the ends to which they might be put and may have wanted very different outcomes for them, those deep irrational desires that I mentioned. That photo that we had at the beginning of Eva Carriere, the spiritualist medium, is from this book by this guy von Schrenck-Notzig, which is a great name. He's a physician turned psychologist who was one of the really astonishing range of scientists and engineers who saw in 19th century media technologies ways to talk to the dead. The chemist and physicist Sir William Crookes, the guy whose work on vacuum tubes, especially early cathode ray tubes, would prove hugely valuable in the history of digital electronic computation. He was working with seances. He was in pursuit of this substance that he called radiant matter. People who did significant work in telephony and radio and photography were all part of this phenomenon, from Graham Bell to Oliver Lodge. So it's not just a matter of saying, ha-ha, they were wrong, although, of course, they were, but a part of the adoption of these media was the story that they offered at this time. These were new technologies that were picking up energies that were invisible to human senses, whether those were X-rays or radio waves or photographs that could capture instants faster than the eye could see. You can see this kind of tragic desire being read into these technologies, that they can save us from our grief and fear of death by revealing an invisible world that we're sure must be there. Just to completely provoke and pick a fight, I think certain aspects of the singularity and certain projects related to strong AI can be seen as somewhat culturally parallel. Just to, poke at the wasp's nest, we can get back to that. So this is kind of what studying dead media is about. The phenomena of materialization, which is to say how things get material, how they get real, or how they don't. And following on that, how the media can tell us about the time when these things became real or didn't. What we then had stories for, what we wanted, and what we were willing to accept. And then maybe we can see the same about our own present day. And how much we misunderstood when we built these new platforms. I'll get to this in a second, but I just wanted to have that image up while talking about this. Edison saw his version of the phonograph, of phonography, as being pretty much exclusively for the human voice, not for music. You wanted it to send letters and business correspondence. Many of the early phonographic cylinder machines included a shaver so that you could shave the cylinder clean after you'd received it and record your own new message on it to send it back. Voicemail, of a very literal kind. There were all kinds of projects on a complete, phonographs for voice, but then also all these projects to use the telephone for music, for live music. This is one of my personal favorites. This is the playing platform of the Telharmonium. It was a 200-ton electric organ in a concert hall in New York City with these enormous tone wheels. That's a kid leaning against one of the tone wheels for scale. These enormous tone wheels and modified dynamos that had to produce enough power that you could pump out a nice, clean signal to all the subscribers to the service. So the idea was that you would subscribe, and then you would get this notice of like the time and the place, and you would dial in a number from your home phone in your apartment in New York City. You would hook a horn up to the part that you would, you know, put your ear to. And then you would get this someone playing this synthesizer in Midtown, like being piped in live. It was also supposed to serve a Muzak-like function. You could pipe it into hotel lobbies and restaurants, and you could stop having to hire a live band. Mark Twain was completely charmed by this. He said, I have to postpone my death until I can hear this again and again. I haven't been able to find any recordings of it, but this was one of the first electronic synthesizers, and apparently from descriptions, it probably sounded a little like a Hammond organ on steroids. It was actually quite a popular idea, but there was, as those of you who have had any encounters with like telephonic engineering are probably guessing at this point, there was some crosstalk issues with pumping this incredibly powerful signal out into the wires. So what that would mean is you're talking to a friend, it's 1908, and the two of you are on your phones, and then suddenly there's someone blasting Wagner at you on the synthesizer, like you sort of stumbled into a Tangerine Dream concert. So you can see that it wasn't really like a net neutrality issue that got them to convince the inventor Cahill to knock it off. And there was actually a long-term afterlife to this kind of idea. There was a device called the Shivers Multiphone. It was like a jukebox that would be at your table in a restaurant. And you'd place from that jukebox, you'd drop in a coin, and you'd place a request call to this basement full of DJs in Seattle. And they would put on a record for you. They would take your cut, and they would play the track back to the telephone line. This was a viable business for more than a decade. You know, these things have very strange prehistories, but they make sense. It seems bizarre to us now to think of telephones for music and records for voice, but it makes sense culturally if you are still thinking of music as a live phenomenon, and if you are thinking of letters as the fundamental means by which you engage in distant communication with people. And if you conceive of records as erasable media for language, why not use it for interspecies communication? This is Richard Lynch Garner. If you'll forgive a little aside, he is one of my absolute favorite sidelights in the history of analog recording. He's pictured here in a specially built 7-by-7-foot cage by the Ogowai River in West Africa, where he was listening to the apes and attempting to speak with them. He was obsessed with this idea of cross-species communication and universal languages, and he used an Edison phonograph in the zoos of Philadelphia and Chicago to make recordings of apes and other primates speaking, try to slow them down and see if he could like get to the atomic syllables of their utterances in the same way that Muybridge's photographs could show you every stage of the motion of a horse. But then he would like saw up the phonographic cylinders and stitch them together to talk back to the apes, to play their own speech back to them. He was like a linguistic DJ, you know, manipulating these records. And in a setback, which I'm sure this audience is uniquely poised to sympathize with, he actually couldn't take his Edison machine with him to Africa because of patent reasons related to overseas purchase and sale. So this poor guy had been preparing for this his entire life, and now he gets to sit without the phonograph, sweating in this linen suit in this cage, taking notes by hand. Moving on from these misunderstandings and different interpretations, how much our original ideas might differ from our later adoption, what about the completely different forms that I mentioned above? These alternate futures that don't look like anything that we have subsequently. You can see how something like the Telharmonium was a little premature, but we can understand it by analogy to Muzak and to live concerts on the radio. What's really neat is coming across these completely different forms, other branches of the tree. Things like pilgrim mirrors, these were a late medieval form. Enormous importance was placed at this time on the act of pilgrimage, going to a place where, for instance, a monastery kept the relic of a saint or a martyr. That's sort of a minor historical figure in pilgrim dress. There was a whole costume. You would recognize them. They moved in enormous crowds around the landscape of medieval Europe. There were battles over who got to have a particular bone fragment or piece of the true cross or vial of uncoagulating blood, because the revenues from all the pilgrims coming through town were a vital part of the lives of towns and religious institutions. And there was this secondary market in these things called pilgrim mirrors, which were these metal badges that were made of an alloy of lead and tin, and they were like a convex surface that you'd polish to a mirror finish, or you know, what would pass in medieval Europe for a mirror finish, because the standards were a little lower. And the idea was that you would then hold these mirrors up to holy relics, and then you would bring them home from the pilgrimage to your family, because these were objects that had held the sacred thing on their surface for a little while. It had seen it in some sense and had a bit of the holiness as a result. So it was like a camera with no film, no recording surface, but the image had been reflected there once. It had sort of held it for a second. And part of the reason why these are more than just a historical curiosity is the metallurgist and smith Gutenberg financed the process of creating movable type by making and selling pilgrim mirrors in large volumes. There's a kind of wonderful historical irony to the fact that he was using the money from making pilgrim mirrors to produce the invention, the medium that would shake the kind of religious world that made pilgrimage a possibility to its core. So given a conceptual camera with no film, what about a television with no images? Ladies and gentlemen, the dream machine. And no, not this dream machine, although the Xanadu model of hypertext in its various conceptual forms and code is a fascinating subject in media history. I don't know how many people were actually exposed to the computer lib dream machines books that Ted Nelson produced when he was inventing the idea of hypertext, but they're fascinating. Moving on. It's this dream machine that we're talking about. Right in the middle there, being employed by William S. Burroughs on the right, noted literary mutant and heir to one of the last great adding machine fortunes in history. And this guy, Brian Geisen, on the left, who's a painter and kind of professional strange character. Both men were inspired by the work of this neurophysiologist, William Gray Walter, who is here pictured with one of his robots, which he called tortoises, which were these early sort of semi-autonomous robots that would roam around his lab, attracted to light and flirting with each other. They were very strange. Gray Walter was one of those scientists, you know, this kind of type of scientist who's also a skin diver and an anarchist and a proponent of free love and a believer in electroshock therapy to cure the problems of the world. He did a lot of significant work in EEG technology. This is one of his early EEGs, where the display was actually these metal plates mounted in a cabinet over there that would rattle as different sectors of the brain began to show activity. So you were actually like watching this kind of like mosaic of gleaming plates like shivering back and forth to show where the activity was. But so he was working on this kind of legitimate stuff, but what really fascinated him was the problem of flicker, the ways the brain responds to stroboscopic light. So setting aside the implications for understanding epilepsy and so on, Gray Walter was very intrigued by the patterns certain frequencies produced when they were flashing against closed eyelids. I quote, "A sort of pulsating check or mosaic, often in bright colors, whirling spirals, whirlpools, explosions, Catherine wheels," which, of course, in the research climate of the 1950s and 60s, meant that clinical psychologists took what Gray was working on with flicker and applied it to their LSD trials. Because why not, you know? I'm really glad we're not in that period of research anymore. From there, the idea bled over into the psychedelic community. And a friend of Burroughs and Geisen, who's also, again, pictured here in his tie, a math student and programmer named Ian Somerville, who used a Honeywell 200 series machine for his art project, speaking of dead platforms, designed a plan. You can cut holes out of a sheet of cardstock and then tape the sheet into a cylinder. And then you put the cylinder on a record player's turntable. And when it's spinning at 78 RPM and you have a 100-watt bulb in the center, it should produce something very close to Gray Walter's ideal levels of flicker for creating visual phenomena. So and it uses only materials that an average hippie would have around the house. So what we have here then is something between like a neurological toy that's like almost like an analog, kind of analog screensaver, and a piece of abstract art that's meant to be seen with your eyes closed. But Guisin didn't want to stop there because he thought that this could be nothing less than the replacement for television. And he actually got Columbia Records interested in this. Because when you think about it, why would you have to sit there and watch like Gilligan's Island reruns and cigarette ads when you could actually just watch the endless patterns generated out of your own visual cortex? So you had this image of like people coming home and sitting down on the couch and just kind of like closing their eyes and experiencing all these visions. Yeah, Columbia, you know, they were already in the business of things turning on record tables. This might be the future of entertainment for a very different sense of entertainment than the one that we use today. So changing gears abruptly, another imageless form, though, to follow our imageless television. This isn't a painting, but it's a device for making things painterly. It's a mirror for the world rather than for a person. It's the clawed glass, also known as the black mirror, though they weren't always black. It was like a little machine for producing a very specific emotion. Every age has these kind of like dominant emotions that are particular to it, and some of them are really hard to understand later, though they were very real and powerful in their moment, as real as the things that we experience today, very modern experiences. And the media technologies of a particular time help us understand the feelings of that time. And one of the crucial experiences of the 18th century was the picturesque, which doesn't just mean looking good the way it sort of does today, like quaint and pretty. The picturesque was a powerful kind of experience. People had been arguing for decades that the experience of beauty was fundamentally rational, and you could see it in Newtonian physics just as much as you could see it in painting or Bach or what have you. Then there was this idea, though, that came up after this argument had been going on for a while about the sublime, that we don't just want to see things that are pretty and confirm our sense of comely structure. We get something out of vast mountains, wastelands, ruins, forests, the open sea, like all these things that fill us with awe and horror. I feel like you can see the sublime in most major Hollywood blockbusters today. There's always these scenes of wild landscapes and depths and abysses. The picturesque lay between these two emotions, between rational beauty and kind of crazy sublime. And it sort of was like a combination of the beautiful landscape and then like kind of ruins and crumbling spaces and everything under this very particular kind of light, this dramatic light. And this one guy, Claude Lorraine, this painter, was the exemplar of this style and was an absolute rock star in his own time. He specialized in these scenes of little figures who were engaged in these various mythological errands against vast backdrops, often with shadows of ruins and earlier ages. These lonely souls in a vast world. Sometimes he would make it kind of pastoral and bright, but most of the time it had all these like dark green shadows and this weird livid sunset light, the sense of, you know, doom and drama. So the idea of the clawed glass, which was enormously popular, was that you would have this kind of tourist's map of a particular area, and it would direct you to ideal viewing places for particular vistas. So you would, you know, go to this lookout over the Alps or somewhere in the British Isles, and you'd find a spot, and then you would turn away from it, and you would look at it as reflected in the mirror held in your hand. Because you didn't really want the landscape, you wanted the painter's version of it. This is 18th century augmented reality. The mirror would subtract the confusing details, it would distort the perspective, it would bring out the outlines, it would make some colors brighter and others darker. If the mirrors were tinted other than black, you could actually get whole other effects, and people would have like libraries of these in various spectra. Goethe really liked violet because he thought, and I quote, a purple-colored glass reveals a landscape in the hue that must be spread over earth and sky in the day of judgment. So it's like this little miniature, like thrilling experience. We can think of these as almost being like handheld Photoshop filters for an emotional state. I like to imagine these people turned away from the Alpine Vista to look into their mirror as being like the 18th century version of the folks you see now who are looking down into the digital camera to fiddle with the image in the display with like the onboard editor rather than actually looking out at what they've taken the image of. So there are media whose use transforms dramatically with time, and there are media that were so different they never found purchase in the general population. And there are media that were part of a cultural experience that's largely disappeared, and they went with it. But what about the media that were ahead of their time conceptually, but faced insurmountable hardware problems? This last category of the unsuccessful takes us to the project of making music visually, of analog WYSIWYG music production. This category includes things like music boxes and player pianos, and that's a part of a player piano role there. I just love them. They're really beautiful representations of music. But let's cut to something stranger and more interesting, Oramix. This is the brainchild of Daphne Oram, who co-founded the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, which was like the MIT Tech Model Railroad Club for electronic music in the 1960s. Like, everybody came up with amazing things there. Delia Derbyshire, who did the Doctor Who theme, like among a million other things, worked there. This guy, Brian Hodgson, is playing a completely kludgy synthesizer that they made with cannibalized piano keys and a bunch of oscillators that they stole from elsewhere in the BBC. Equipment procurement. So Oram, though, was moving in a completely different direction, one with very few precedents. Here she is at work on it. What she had created was a system where you could draw forms directly on these strips of clear 35-millimeter film, and their interference, registered by photocells as the film advanced, would shape the intensity, the pitch, and the envelope, and so on, by modulating the voltage being passed to the oscillators and the filters. It was monophonic, but you could, like, multi-track the output, and you could make astonishing dense stuff. This is pure synthesis, interacting with sound as a visual shape. What you see is what you get. Here's an excerpt of a multi-tracked Oramix piece, and we're going to see how this sounds. Very space age. So there was a parallel project behind the Iron Curtain called the ANS synthesizer. The ANS actually gets its initials from Alexander Scriabin, who was a composer who was fascinated by the overlap between visual things and sonic things, so much that he actually put pieces into his symphonies for organs that would project colors rather than play particular sounds. He wanted the audience to wear all white, so they would be like the projection surface. You know, they would suddenly be in red space when a particular chord would be played. So that's a sheet of black mastic on a pane of glass. And you make scratches on the surface, and then you kind of slide it through the machine, which reads the score by the passage of light as modulated by these glass wheels, and they go into photocells, and then amps and bandpass filters, and then it goes to 800 oscillators. It's an amazing production. The music sounds like this. As you can imagine, this was used a lot in Soviet science fiction movies in the 1970s. It's very like, you know, the spaceship coming into land kind of sound. Actually, yeah, if you've seen like the original Solaris, this appears on the soundtrack a lot. However, these two forms don't seem all that unusual in retrospect. Like, we're really used to this idea of visual composition now. We don't have to put up with the problems of batch processing the way Oram did, where you had to know exactly what you were going for and work it out in advance by sight before running it through to tape without real-time feedback. You know, we fiddle with waveforms, this is Pro Tools, of course, or we reshape sound by hooking different components together and adjusting them in real time, this is Max MSP. It's a totally straightforward way for thinking about the interface lexicon of digital sound. And by the end of her life, Oram was re-implementing her Oramix work on an Apple II and an Acorn Archimedes. So this begs the question, does any medium, device, or platform really die, or does it just get absorbed? So this is the fifth of five conclusions that I'd like to leave you with from the world of dead media. And it's that real, total, non-recoverable death is actually really rare. We use the term dead media, but most media is actually in a strange other state. Media technologies may no longer rule the roost, but they continue to be maintained and practiced, whether as emulations. I'm not sure if you can see that very clearly, but this is a PDP-11 emulator running in my browser. It's enormously fun to sit there and fiddle around with this thing. Or as hobbyist projects. Like, plenty of people still know how to do calligraphy and raise carrier pigeons and practice semaphore and do heraldry. Or some media persist as an industrial heritage, the way the QWERTY keyboard keeps alive the tradition of the manual typewriter. I type in Dvorak, which is the future, but unfortunately, no one really rallies to my call when I try to convince them that they should waste 2 weeks switching over to another keyboard map. Everyone here who's using ThinkPads, like the gently scooped keys of your keyboards, are actually a direct heritage from the IBM Selectric keyboards. They had a very similar, they had a design for those that was meant for that particular rhythm of typing that the Selectrix enabled, and they just adapted those for ThinkPads. However, there's also a whole class of seemingly dead forms that have actually really just finally found a niche that really suits them, such as Morse code. So compared to voice and email and so on, Morse is terrible for day-to-day casual conversation and dense exchange, but it's fantastic for bad, noisy, restricted situations. It needs no computer. It has no real language barrier for emergency signals. It's faster than text messaging, if you're good at it. And it's not just ham radio operators that know it. Special forces groups like the SAS use it because you can easily rig up a transmitter to send dots and dashes in a situation where you couldn't get voice going. And you can use it in prisons to tap on pipes and walls. This is a format where you can communicate by blinking your eyes. So it's almost as though in the process of dying out from widely adopted casual use, it's actually found a space for which it's uniquely suited. Many media do this. They find a niche after their quote-unquote death that's actually a better fit. There are a few artists working with black mirrors again, and once in a while I will pass through like a sort of anarchist squat, or I grew up in Northern California, or a hippie kind of household, and I'll see a dream machine, you know, spinning away on its little turntable. So while death may be rare, loss is common, and that's in many ways the real concern, and I'll get to that at the end. The fourth is another way in which prior media, old media, dead media, remain useful to us and survive, because they offer us a way into new technologies. And I've based this on this helpful acronym, MAYA, Most Advanced Yet Acceptable. It was coined by this guy, Raymond Loewy, who's an industrial designer who is probably as responsible as anybody for the look and feel of mid-century America. This is the guy who designed the Lucky Strikes carton and the Greyhound bus and the second generation Coca-Cola bottle and can, streamlined locomotives, the interior of Skylab. Like, this was someone who had extraordinary influence, quite successful, and his concept was most advanced yet acceptable, MAYA. This is a drawing from his studio that kind of shows this in action. His idea was you should look forward to a vision of the future where things are ultimately headed, where they should be, but people aren't ready for that yet. So you kind of dial it back from the projection until you arrive at something that's still recognizable enough to be understandable and therefore attractive and useful. And what we see in the development of media is that prior forms are needed because they act like gateways and handrails. Think of the office metaphor and the page metaphor in GUI operating systems, the history of icons, the way some digital cameras have a sound file of a shutter clicking that they will play back as the imaging surface is capturing to kind of help you understand what's going on. So it's not just to say that very, very few media forms or practices ever really go away, but also that some of them offer pathways into new forms. So you can start to get to grips with the idea of photography if you first start seeing it as the pencil of nature, which was the title of William Fox Talbot's book about photography, the first photo-illustrated book, this huge introduction of the idea. This is actually a calotype, which was like a pre-photograph made with silver iodide. But it was meant, he made this picture to imitate the then popular Dutch school of painting in Britain in the 1840s. So it's sort of like, okay, this is insta-painting. This is painting you can do without talent. That's how we can understand what photography is. And then after a while, you can begin to understand photography as a form in itself, with these unique powers of capturing moments, of long exposures, of being able to glance in a way that a painting can't, and see things that a human eye might not see. And then, photographs as we know them offer the way into digital photography, which has completely different properties. Not least, if you'll forgive this, how incredibly manipulable it is, which I find sort of fascinating. Everyone probably recognizes the famous Situation Room photograph of the death of Bin Laden up there in the corner, which within hours had the cat added and then was turned into the DC superhero lineup and then had basically every cultural figure of interest to internet meme people added. It was a kind of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band celebration of the event. Like, this is kind of radically different from something you would take on, you know, on film and then retouch by hand if you had the skill to do that. These are being done by amateurs very, very rapidly. This is a whole different domain, but the idea of the photograph helps us kind of step into that. Steve Sasson, who was developed one of the first digital cameras, he settled on a number of images that he could capture to tape storage, which is what he was using, as 30, because it lay between 24 and 36 exposures, which was normal for roll film. His argument was, if you can only take one or two pictures, then kind of what's the point? And if you can take 1,000, which you can, well, people might not be ready for that, because it's a completely different relationship with images. It's a different relationship with photos. He put it really, really well. Put everything very much like the cultures used to, and then put in your idea, and only the essential elements. Once people are inside the new medium, once they're kind of exploring and playing because they know how to get into it, the unique capabilities will be found, of which this might not be the best example, but it's still kind of amazing. So the third takeaway is kind of a two-parter with the second. The third is convergence. Part of the reason there's so many obscure dead media platforms is that inventors and creators tend to converge, which is to say that everything gets invented over and over and over again, often independently and often in different places. This isn't just recent examples like VHS Betamax or CDs versus mini discs and DAT and El Cassette and so on. Bell and Gray famously applied for the telephone patent on the same day. But there were at least three others working independently who already had working versions of telephones years before with, you know, variations in different details. Edison had his version. This guy Antonio Meucci had an 1860 patent on the teletrofono, which he had working successfully in Staten Island. He just had bad timing and business trouble. He was really, really strict about trying to only raise money from his fellow Italians. And the problem was that, like, Italy was in the middle of unification when he was trying to raise money, which is a bad time to come ask, like, rich people, you know, hey, would you like to put up some of your assets that might be being seized by the armies of Garibaldi towards this unknown, you know, business venture? So this isn't even to talk about, just as an example, moving image technology. This is just a partial list. This was invented so many different times in so many different ways. So one of the ways that you can look for interesting moments, both in the history of media and in our present day, is to look for those moments of flourishing where all these different people are collectively exploring the search space of what moving images or recorded sound or digital video or social networking could be. And it's normal for most of them to not make it. Which brings us to the second takeaway. Because all these failed, variant, or obsolete media are a fund of alternatives. Alternate methods for recording and representing, alternate ideas of what these things are for, alternate futures that could have been. They're an enormous design resource. Whenever we struggle with breaking out of the present way of thinking about how we do things, they're here to kind of shake us up and suggest these different means and approaches. I hope that some of the things I've talked about so far have suggested some of these alternatives, but there are so many others. The remote control, as a random example, originally begins with something called the Flashmatic, which wasn't for like changing channels and making it easier to enjoy your television experience. It was so you could mute commercials as an act of protest. The idea was that they'd sell a lot of these, and then advertisers would panic because they would think that people were muting their ad campaigns, and then television would have to become more educational and civic as a result. As you know, that did not actually take place. But it's kind of neat, because it's like an analog version of an ad-blocking plugin, you know? Or the panic around TiVos. Or there was an unrealized project called the Reedies by this guy Bob Brown. He had a few prototypes kicking around, but none of them worked very well. In the 1920s, he was like, okay, look, music is changing, movies are changing, but we're still reading in the same way. Why don't we read differently? So he built these machines that were based around, like, stock tickers and film reels, you know, with the little like single line of text. And the notion was that you would have a whole novel on this little spool, and you would mount it in this machine, and it would whirl by really fast, and you would just kind of skim. It would be very kind of action-oriented. And often when I'm like, you know, skimming through like an RSS feed reader that's on auto-scroll, I find myself thinking again of the Reedies system. There are millions of these, and they offer wonderful ways to kind of rethink the way we do things now. But for a surprising adaptation right now, I'd like to just turn to music for a second. That's trivial, but true, to say that we live in a period of phenomenal information abundance and access. I mean, which everyone here is in many ways responsible for, and it's fantastic. But there's one area where it's kind of a problem. Because there are no obscure albums anymore, there are no obscure bands. If anybody should have cause to look, I mean, if they're interesting, people will find them. You know, there's no like, I can remember the days, my dad's a record collector, and I can remember the days when there would be like all this money going into like, you know, finding certain reel-to-reels, you know, or finding like really old, like, you know, particular records, that's completely gone. Like, they're ripped to MP3, and you find them on blogs, and they're free. And it's obviously illegal, but setting that aside. So the one thing that this is a problem with is coolness. Because coolness in subcultures has a lot to do with difficulty. It's how you separate the newbies, how you figure out who really belongs, who's really paid their dues. You need secrecy, and you need obscurity. You need to be hard to get, and there has to be kind of a learning curve. So there are bands now who make their names using unusual Unicode symbols and weird ASCII characters. This is actually a band name that I projected here. The point of this being that you can't talk about them, and you can't Google them. They can still like distribute music online through some kind of like, you know, covert address or something like that, but they're incredibly difficult to find. There's also bands that choose names that are totally generic, so they'll be buried a million sites deep. Or my personal favorite, pornographic. So they use the army of like search engine optimizing porn sites as a way of making sure that they're really, really hard to find, because you have to go through a lot of pages before you're going to get to them. So you have to know who to ask and how to talk about it to track them down. You can actually see the same thing in what I realize will be a laughable phenomenon to everyone here, which is cassette-only music labels, which are now existing, and believe it or not, are the new hot thing in certain circles, like metal and certain kinds of obscure musical genres. What they're doing is deliberately reintroducing friction and like turning systems for finding things, turning them against the purpose of being found, because it's the work that bonds people together in the subculture, and it's the work that makes the music feel valuable and special and secret. So they've taken these technologies that are meant to enable communication, like Unicode, and they've turned them into these systems for mystification. So the last or first takeaway, and I think in some ways the most important from dead media, is to think about the long run in your work. Because as John Maynard Keynes put it in one of my favorite quotes from any economist, in the long run, we are all dead. I work a lot with librarians and archivists, and I love it because they care intensely about the past and the future both. And they understand that every medium is of its time, technologically and culturally, and it will pass. Things will change, the context that made it interesting will go away, or its functionality will be eaten by something bigger or better. It ends up as a hobbyist relic or a museum piece, or for the very, very few things, an invisible part of daily life for centuries. It's easy to lose sight of this, especially in the world of digital media, because what we've created, what you guys are creating, is something genuinely new and strange in the world, something advancing faster than anything has ever advanced before and changing in radical ways. However, that doesn't mean that it escapes the great clock. So as a public service, and as a rule of thumb, if you're building something, if you're contributing something, and I'm in some ways thinking of the development of cloud computing and storage in this light, what is the envisioned destiny for it? A decade out, a century out, a millennium out? The Long Now Foundation would want me to push this out another order of magnitude, but let's stick with that scale for now. Is the survival of what people have done with that medium contingent on a company paying the air conditioning bills for the server farm? How portable are things? Is it relatively easy for some unknown future scientist or programmer who is building on your work to figure out what it was doing so they can pull it into the new system that they've developed for whatever new hardware they've invented? Which is to say, can it be documented? How is the documentation? How does that work? What's the future case for it? This is a spread from Ibn al-Haytham, or al-Hassan's, landmark treatise on optics, which is a fantastic book in the history of science, enormously influential. And it happens to be almost 1,000 years old today. We can read it fine. It's beautifully made the transition to Latin and Hebrew, to other languages, and to movable type and PDF files. Do we have a sense that what we work on here will be as amenable to preservation and to transformation in the future? This is from an announcement that Brewster Kahle of the Internet Archive made about a week ago. The Internet Archive is going to start keeping one physical copy of every book that they have in the archive, in cardboard boxes, each correlated to its digital copy, 40,000 to a shipping container. One reason for this, Kahle put beautifully, when they were making microfilm of books, they thought they would never have to rescan them. When they were being scanned at 300 dpi, they thought they would never have to scan them again. We know that someday these books will be rescanned. They will be waiting here in boxes. Which is simply to say that even though I'm pretty sure that this is a room full of the smartest people that I've ever had the privilege to address, we are not smarter than everyone who is going to come after us, who is going to develop new hardware, new systems, new languages, new forms, quantum computing, who knows? And they are going to build on the work that we're doing here and that people do who use the systems that we create to produce things that we don't even know how to imagine yet. So here's the thing about dead media. Here's the final takeaway. It's not really dead, it's just sleeping. And we want to make what we create as easy as possible for the future to reawaken. I'd like to close with this image. It's the stained glass window that Gerhard Richter produced for the Köln Cathedral in Germany, which is a building that was under construction for more than 600 years, and there's still a fair amount of work being done there. The stained glass windows in the cathedral have been added gradually. There's some from the 14th century, there's some from the 19th, and a window was lost during the Allied bombing of Germany, so Richter created this one in the last decade. I like to imagine it standing for the next 800 years or so, a monument to our particular moment. It's incredibly beautiful in person. If you're ever passing through Cologne, you have to stop in and see it. It's 11,500 pieces of glass, pixels of a sort, whose arrangement has been randomly generated. It's such a fantastic symbol of where we're at right now, just barely launched into the ocean of digital electronic computation. Not even a century has passed from Turing and von Neumann and ENIAC to us in this room now. So here's to the next 1,000 years. Thanks so much for your attention, and I'd be glad to take questions.
If you do have questions, I encourage you to use the microphones. And since nobody is rushing, I would like to add my own comment. Your note about waveforms and piano rolls and so on, I go to a camp every summer where they have a player piano, and so we have piano rolls dating from the turn of the century up through ABBA and Queen. And yet when I compose music, since I'm a illiterate when it comes to sheet notation, I compose in piano roll notation.
Oh, wow, really?
And my a cappella group, I stand in on all of the recordings, and although I don't know how to use Pro Tools, I can point to where in the waveform I want the edit. And that's where we'll do the editing, because I can recognize the shape. So it's amazing how all of that ties together.
Yeah, no, exactly. And there's actually, again, with the sort of like different thing than people thought it was going to be, one of the original ideas with piano rolls was that they were going to be more like, they were almost like the piano equivalent of like Eliza or something. And that the idea was that you wouldn't just like sit there and watch it play, you would play the role so you could then play like, you know, variations and arpeggios, you could add stuff to the sound. It was like four-handed piano. You were playing with your mechanical companion. And then that sort of went away and it became this kind of like pure playback system. Any other questions or stories or comments?
We can also sing along to some of the piano rolls because they have the words printed on them.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, you didn't mention Rick Vero, and yeah. You didn't mention Wilford's Lumia chord.
Yes.
Yeah, which is amazing. And he also did, I saw an art exhibit in Washington, D.C. in the 70s, and he had these machines, and the machines were designed so they had a number of gears, and all the gears had odd numbers. Mm. And so, oh, actually not just odd numbers, prime numbers. Hmm. So when you put the gears together, you get patterns that would not repeat for like 123 years.
Wow.
And there would be rotating devices with gels for color and patterns. And so it would very gradually, you know, you could stare at one of these for hours and you could sort of think you're getting a pattern and then you'd never see it again because you wouldn't live long enough. So it was an interesting in dead media, but when I was fascinated enough that I actually tried to create some of these things.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
Are they available? Like, do you have?
No, they're all long dead and gone. But I do have. I'm still interested in creating something like this. But just it's like the long clock, you know,
yeah,
the
one that yeah.
century clock, millennium clock, right?
Yeah.
Well, I like that idea that you actually create something that does have a pattern, but it's such a long pattern, it's way beyond human existence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you end up thinking very far into the future. No, there's a whole fantastic history of light shows and forms of that kind of mm-hmm. display, but there was already such an overload being brought into this that I wanted to kind of keep going. But
yeah, I was more or less curious whether you were just aware of it, and it was. I mean, he had an organ, so when he played music, certain colors would be displayed, similar to a couple of things that you mentioned.
Yeah, there's wonderful like elements of synesthesia that turn up, where people would come up with various correlations. There were projects to, there's actually one thing that I did not have a chance to bring up, but there's a wonderful history to something that I wish had actually taken off, which was the smell organ. There were a lot of different projects to like develop things where you would mix different scents, and there was like a kind of harmonic structure to them, so you would kind of generate. The one problem is that, as you can imagine, unless you have a lot of ventilation, it becomes intolerable after, you know, just imagine like, you know, playing a piano where every note just sustains for a really long time. You know, it's just cacophony after a little while. But if anyone wants to help me drum up some venture capital, I would love to imagine, you know, a smell organ in every home, sort of experience different scents.
Symphony and bacon cheeseburger.
Yes, yeah, exactly. A little bit of smoke, a little bit of mesquite. Yes, sir.
Joseph Schwartz, do you know how archivists deal with media that's used in an alternate way? I transfer lots of video, and Beta is often used as a pure audio source for Grateful Dead fans. So how do they deal with the fact that sometimes when you actually play the media, you can't actually get what you're expecting out of it, and sometimes you have to use an alternate source from that deck to get the actual content?
That's a really interesting example. And it's a great question, because it's because this is part of the thing, is you can't just like have you can't just have the object. You also kind of have to have a certain sense of the context just to know how to use it, you know, how to interact with it, or what people were getting from it at the time, so that you can get something like that out of it now. How they were reading it, how they were patching into it. For what it's worth, a lot of the things, I mention this because, especially when it comes to things like just thinking of the grid computing systems that are being used with the Large Hadron Collider, like, we who are trying to preserve stuff and move things into the future have no idea how to deal with data at that volume over the very long term. Because, you know, obviously we don't want this moment of history to be, in retrospect, like this weird dark ages where, like, things survive, but there are, like, enormous chunks of stuff that you would want to use for scientifically reproducible experiments or as, like, the social document of a time. So that would just kind of, like, go away, you know, that, like, whether... If you want to look at it at the very short term, like whether someone would just forget to, you know, like transfer it onto a new hard drive or like, you know, manage that whole process and keep the data from getting corrupted and make sure that they still had the right like set of operating systems, programs, and languages to work with whatever they were recovering. Or if you want to look at it in the super long term, Clay Shirky has a fantastic example of this where he talks about like, you know, something that was written on an Apple Macintosh that's truly important, you know, like the original Constitution, and you want to keep the, imagining that they wrote the Constitution on a Mac, and you want to keep the canonical version, you know, available. And so every so often you like take it out of its tank of pH neutral mineral oil and you dry it off and you fire it up again. But then what happens when you're like a couple centuries out and maybe AC power, which is a fairly recent invention, has stopped being used in the way that maybe there's, you know, other systems available. So then you have to kind of reconstruct, you know, the voltage source, and you have to create a plug for it to run from, and so on. These things gradually keep like moving into a larger context, and that becomes very problematic with preserving these kinds of media.
If there are no other questions, Finn, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.